Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Geneva. Today is Friday, 11th of October, and we have the great pleasure to start this briefing with two guests from the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. We have with us Ruvendrini Menik-Diwela, the Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, on my right, and Dipti Gurung, longtime Nepalese stateliness campaigner, and Nansen as a winner. So I'll give the floor to our colleagues immediately for their initial remarks. Mrs. Menik-Diwela.
Thank you, Alessandra. So today we're actually here because we're releasing a very, very important report to mark a decade of action to address statelessness. And I'm sure you all know this, but UNHCR is not just a UN refugee agency. We also have a global mandate to prevent and end statelessness. And 10 years ago, our then High Commissioner, Antonio Guterres, who's now the Secretary General, actually initiated this campaign called I Belong. And the objective of it was really to mobilize governments to pay global attention to this issue and to try and bring an end to this really devastating problem. Well, 10 years down the road, unfortunately, we have not succeeded in eliminating statelessness. It is a serious human rights violation. Everybody has a fundamental human right to nationality. Everybody has a fundamental human right not to be arbitrarily deprived of their nationality. And most stateless people live in the margins of society. We all know that. They tend to be stripped of all the legal rights and protections that stem from citizenship and make them even more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. And many of the things that you and I take for granted, whether it's renting an apartment, sending our kids to school, accessing medical care when you're sick, all of these things become almost insurmountable problems for stateless people when they have absolutely no documents to show that they belong. And this is certainly something that Deepti will be speaking to much more extensively from her own personal experience. So I think one of the things that we really want to highlight here is that really statelessness is a solvable issue. It is, I mean, there are lots of things in the world today that we could consider to be completely unresolvable, but this is not one of them. All it takes is political will and a commitment to enact change. For example, by introducing laws and regulations, addressing the gaps and inequities that actually lead to statelessness. All it takes literally sometimes is a stroke of a pen. And the report that we're launching today actually does it show some of the progress that has been made. And there has been quite significant progress and some notable achievements. I won't list them all. They're pretty lengthy. But I will highlight a few of them. One is, of course, that since the start of the campaign, over 500,000 stateless people have acquired citizenship. We have countries like Kyrgyzstan that have resolved the case of every known stateless case on their territory. We have Turkmenistan that is on track to do the same. We have countries like Kenya that have provided citizenship to ethnic minorities on their territories. We have countries like Liberia, Madagascar, and Sierra Leone that have introduced legislation that allow women to pass nationalities onto their children. And we have over 20 plus countries that have introduced national plans of action to end statelessness. So I think those are huge achievements that we really do want to mark as well with the launch of this report. But I'd like to also provide some other critical data, and that is, as of last year, there were some 4.4 million stateless people who were registered. But I do want to underline, though, that this data covers only half of the 193 member states on this planet. So the real numbers are significantly higher and obviously much more difficult to grapple with since we actually don't even know the dimensions of the problem. And the other sobering statistic is that 1.3 million of stateless people are actually forcibly displaced as well. And this relates principally to the Rohingya ethnic minority from Myanmar. I'm sure you all know that there are over a million Rohingya refugees, principally in Bangladesh, but also in other asylum countries in the Asia-Pacific region, and that we have hundreds and thousands of Rohingya who are displaced internally within Myanmar as a result of the conflict. Now, to mark the closure of the I Belong campaign, this 10-year campaign, we will be convening a high-level event next Monday during our annual UNHCR Executive Committee sessions. And it will include some around 100 governments and over 50 representatives of international organizations and civil society. So they will all be there to mark the, or to commemorate, if you like, the achievements of the I Belong campaign. But this event will also serve to launch the Global Alliance to End Statelessness. And this is an alliance that includes member states, private sector, importantly, stateless people themselves and the organizations that they represent, academia, faith-based groups, other UN agencies, you name it. We will be having all of these stakeholders working together with the principal objective of maintaining the momentum and building on the achievements already generated by the I Belong campaign. So, and the end objective we hope is that at the end of this, every single person would have citizenship and a legal identity. I mean, that is really the objective that we're working towards. And as I said, a very, very easily implementable objective if there's political will to do it. But, and I'd like to conclude by saying this, also very importantly, on Monday evening, we will be having a ceremony to honor our this year's Nansen Refugee Medal Award winners. And we do have the immense privilege of having one of the regional winners here, Alessandra just mentioned it, Deepthi Gurung, who has been advocating tirelessly on behalf of stateless people. She will speak much more compellingly about her own experiences than I ever could, but her work really stemmed from the fact that her own children, her two daughters, became stateless. And she has worked tirelessly to reform Nepalese citizenship laws to ensure that this does not happen. And by doing this, she has really managed to help not only her daughter's situation, but also thousands of others in a similar situation. So without further ado, I'd like to hand the floor over to Deepthi. Over to you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity and platform for me to express. It means a lot coming from all the way from Nepal. Good morning, everybody. I hope it's okay if I read it out, right?
Yeah, just a little bit
brief. Yeah. Let's just put it here. So it is a profound privilege to address you today. I'm Deepthi Gurung, co-founder and executive director of Citizenship Affected Peoples Network Nepal, CAPN. My dedication to this cause is deeply personal. I faced a long and painful struggle to secure citizenship for my daughters, Neha and Nikita, and my now husband, Diwakar, and was able to receive his citizenship at the age of 45 after decades of hardship because of gender discriminatory citizenship laws. These challenges drove me to advocate for the rights of all mothers seeking to pass on their nationality to their children. One story that stands out is Sangeeta Karki, orphaned at the young age and raised by her grandmother. Sangeeta fought for over 10 years to secure her citizenship. Despite her success, many other youths continue to face this issue, depriving them of education, employment, and basic rights. Without citizenship, they became vulnerable to human trafficking, exploitation, illegal activities, and drug abuse. Tragically, some have even taken their own lives. These young people who could be contributing to Nepal's development and instead left marginalized. For a developing country like ours, this loss of human potential is catastrophic. Gender discriminatory citizenship law is not just a legal issue, it is a human rights crisis. Denying citizenship strips individuals of dignity and opportunity. This issue is often overshadowed by political narrative, but it is fundamentally about justice and equality. Every child deserves the right to belong, regardless of whether their nationality comes from their mother or father. At CAPN, we are working to change this reality. One of our key initiatives, the Safe Haven Project, provides employment to people impacted by citizenship laws, enabling them to earn a dignified living and helping fund our broader advocacy efforts. Through this initiative, we demonstrate that we are just not individuals without citizenship and also who are treated as threats but valuable contributors to society. While we have made progress, this work would not be possible without the support of organizations that have stood by us despite the challenges they face in garnering sufficient resources. I would like to express my deep gratitude to institutions like Stitching Institute for Statelessness and Inclusion, Nationality for All, Global Campaign for Equal Nationality Rights, and the Global Movement Against Statelessness, which have been pillars of strength for us, despite their own struggles with funding, financial support, and with capacity building as well. We are also deeply thankful to UNHCR, to Kios Foundation Finland, and an ongoing partner, and Julia Taft Fund USA, which have helped us a lot. However, despite these efforts, statelessness remains unfunded globally. We could achieve so much more if this issue receives more financial help and political will it truly deserves. As we gather here today at the United Nations, I urge both global community and our government to view statelessness or people without citizenship through a lens of humanity and inclusion. Nepal has made some progress, and I appreciate these efforts, but we still know that the gender discriminatory citizenship provision exists, and it exists because of the patriarchy prevalent, and the intent needs to be determined and firmed more. We must enact reforms that ensure no child is left stateless and no mother is denied the right to pass on her nationality. Together, we can build a future where every child in Nepal and around the world is given the chance to participate fully in society and contribute to their communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before opening the floor to question, Matt has an announcement also.
And just very briefly to follow up, the press release has been sent on the I Belong report, so you should have that in your inbox. We have also sent an advisory for the full week of events next week, that is XCOM, our annual executive committee meeting. And there are details there on media access and broadcast opportunities. As Reuven mentioned, there will be a high-level segment on statelessness on Monday. That will be followed by the Nansen Award on Monday evening, to which media can have access if they approach UNHCR's press office. And then throughout the rest of the week, there will be a number of sessions here in the Palais, including, of course, the general debate at XCOM, as well as individual sessions on the situation in the Middle East, the situation in Sudan, climate change, the Cartagena process, and several other sessions. So do approach us if you have interest in covering those. Thank you, Alessandra.
Thank you to the three speakers, and I'll open the floor to questions. So I'll start with Isabel. Isabel Sacco is the correspondent of the Spanish news agency.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Alessandra. Just to know if we will receive a detailed program of the XCOM next week, because it would be useful, and to know also if you are expecting the participants, some ministers, to come to Geneva for this meeting.
Yeah, we have sent an advisory, Isabel, and there is a link there that has all of the sessions that are available. There are a number of ministers, ambassadors, partners, NGOs, and so on who will be present.
Gabriela Sotomayor from Mexican Proceso.
Hi, hello. I didn't have the opportunity to read the report, but what do you think about the regime of the Ortega Murillo in Nicaragua that took away the nationality of some members of opposition, intellectuals, some priests, and other personalities? Thank you.
Mrs. Minidiwala, we answer every question. It's a press conference style. Please.
I think I won't go into the individual circumstances of each of these situations, but suffice it to say, as I underlined earlier on, it is one of the fundamental human rights for any person not to be arbitrarily deprived of their nationality, and that's a position we would take in situations where we believe that people have been stripped of their nationality for political purposes or any other purposes.
Are there other questions to UNHCR in the room? Let me see if there's any on the platform. I don't see. Yes, Lisa Schlein, sorry, Voice of America.
Good morning. On statelessness, you were talking about the situation of Myanmar. As we know, they're very resistant to dealing with this, among other issues. What does it take? What sort of persuasive arguments do you have in order to get countries to listen to you, actually, and to consider giving citizenship to the stateless people? And then I was wondering whether you have been able to measure the positive impacts of countries that have, in fact, ended statelessness. I'm looking at the press release, which talks about Kenya, which I guess gave citizenship to a number of minority groups, and what that has done for the societies that have actually granted citizenship to these stateless people. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. In terms of the Rohingya situation and the issue of citizenship for Rohingya members of the Rohingya ethnic minority, this is a long-standing issue, as of course you know, and some of the initiatives that we have undertaken is obviously to lobby with governments in the region to try and persuade the de facto authorities in Myanmar and previous governments as well in Myanmar to address this issue, this very vexed question of granting citizenship or the full rights of citizenship to Rohingya, the Rohingya populations. But we are also, and this is one of the things that this global alliance that we are launching on Monday hopes to do, it's not just to use the persuasive powers of governments, but also other sectors of society, like civil society, like people like Deepti, the private sector. As we all know, sometimes some of these very powerful corporations tend to have more leverage than we in the United Nations may have with certain governments, then other sister agencies, academia, faith-based leaders, faith-based groups. We hope to use all of these in the context of this global alliance to try and mobilize public opinion, but also to try and convince these governments to look more positively at granting citizenship to stateless persons on their territory. In terms of the positive impact, there is recorded evidence that, of course, when people are granted full rights of citizenship and become wage-earning members of society, they do contribute to the communities in which they live, not least through the payment of taxes, through the payment of other, you know, for other services as well, and that they do become contributing members of the economies and the communities in which they live, and we do have data on that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Musa Asi Al-Mayedin.
Merci beaucoup. I have a question about Lebanon, the situation of displaced in Beirut from the south. The situation today, because I see always the images from Beirut, the people sleep in the street, in the garden, in the public space. How you can give us some details about the situation today. Thank you.
Musa, sorry, you're not specifically speaking here about refugees, because otherwise we'll have a whole section in Lebanon as soon as we finish with this. So just to clarify, are you asking this to UNHCR or in general? We can talk about it in a moment.
UNHCR, general. UNHCR, or maybe I can wait to the sector of Lebanon.
Okay. Yeah, let's do it like this, because Matt will stay with us. I think you're, there's one more question, but then we go to Lebanon, to the situation in the Middle East, and Matt will also be there to answer your questions after we have heard from our speakers. But I see Catherine Fiancon, France 24, has a question too. Is that for UNHCR,
yes.
Catherine?
Yes, good morning, Alessandra. Good morning, and thank you for this briefing. I'd like to have your opinion about governments that are removing nationality of people that have been involved in fights in Syria. Most of the time, they removed the nationality of the former fighters and their family.
Okay, I am not aware of the situation on which you are referring to, but again, I do want to underline that there are international human rights instruments that clearly say that no person should be arbitrarily deprived of their nationality, and I would really like to just underline that provision rather than commenting on individual situations where I certainly don't have the knowledge. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was our last question for our guests. Thank you very much for being here. Congratulations again. And have a great event next week. But you stay in the room. I'll ask Ravina to come to the podium. And we have with us, I'd like to make a little bit of a series of presentation on the situation in the Middle East. So we have Ravina to speak about it on the human rights perspective. And we also have Rick Papercorn. Don't need to introduce Rick, but he is the WHO representative for the OPT of WHO. He is connecting from Jerusalem. And Jean Gou, UNICEF special representative in the state of Palestine for UNICEF. So we have updates on Gaza, on polio, but I would like to say Rick has to leave us at 11:30, so we have a hard deadline there. Christian will stay on the line if you have other questions for WHO, but I think I'll start maybe with Ravina here, then we will go to Jerusalem, and then we will hear also from Matt, if you have questions. Ravina, let's start with you.
Thanks, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. The situation for civilians on the ground in Lebanon, Gaza, Israel, and Syria is getting worse by the day. The densely populated capital of Beirut is increasingly being hit by Israeli airstrikes. Hundreds are dead, and over 1 million people have fled their homes throughout the country. Hezbollah and other armed groups continue to fire rockets into Israel, resulting in the first civilian fatalities in the north since the most recent escalation of hostilities between Israel and Lebanon last month. Just last night, Beirut was bombed again, in the heaviest strike yet on the central part of the city. At least 22 people were reported killed and over 100 injured, according to the Ministry of Public Health. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, reminds all parties of their obligation to adhere to international humanitarian law, or the rules of war, with respect to the protection of civilians, civilian objects, and infrastructure. Any alleged violation must be subjected to a prompt and thorough investigation, and those responsible where violations are found to have taken place must be held to account. The Lebanese people are bearing the brunt of this latest phase of the conflict. The Ministry of Public Health says that almost 400 children and women are among the over 2,000 people killed since October 2023. There are recurring reports of essential civilian infrastructure having been struck, including hospitals, clinics, ambulances, and schools, along with the destruction of housing. In all, over 100 medical and emergency workers have been killed across Lebanon since October last year. Many of those displaced have fled to Syria. From the 23rd of September to the 9th of October, it has been reported that over 310,000 Syrians and nearly 110,000 Lebanese citizens have crossed the border. On the 9th and the 10th of October, Hezbollah said it had launched at least 360 missiles from southern Lebanon into Israel. Two people were killed in a rocket attack on the border town of Kiryat Shmona on the 9th of October, a day after five others were injured in a rocket attack on Haifa. Amid this escalating violence, we are appalled by the sweeping inflammatory language on multiple sides. Recent language threatening Lebanese people as a whole and calling on them to either rise up against Hezbollah or face destruction like Gaza risks being understood as encouraging or accepting violence directed against civilians and civilian objects in violation of international law. Ongoing denigration of the UN, in particular UNRWA, is unacceptable. This kind of toxic rhetoric from any source must stop. It is important that we also keep the spotlight on the frightful human suffering continuing in Gaza. Over the last week, the Israeli military has intensified operations in North Gaza, further severing the area from the rest of the Gaza Strip and risking afresh the lives of civilians in the areas. Intense strikes, shelling, quadcopter shootings, and ground incursions have occurred over the past days, hitting residential buildings and groups of people, causing numerous casualties, and once again, mass displacement of Palestinians in the area. Attacks on hospitals also continue. One strike on Al-Yaman Al-Said Hospital, serving as an IDP shelter in Jabalia camp, killed 17 Palestinians, including children and women. On the 9th of October, the Israeli military ordered the evacuation within 24 hours of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, the largest operating hospital in northern Gaza, impacting hundreds of injured, other patients and medical workers, as well as residents that rely on the hospital. Meanwhile, in other parts of Gaza, a strike on Rufaida School, sheltering IDPs in the west of Deir al-Bala on the 10th of October, reportedly killed 28 Palestinians, including children and women. We have recorded at least 14 schools struck this October alone, at a rate of more than one school a day. While the Israeli military continues to order Palestinians in North Gaza to leave, many are trapped and cannot safely move. Our office has received reports that those most vulnerable, including people with disabilities and their families, are especially struggling to evacuate. The High Commissioner stresses that now, more than ever, political courage, leadership, and compassion are needed. The killing, destruction, as well as the bellicose posturing by those in positions of power must end. There is no alternative to resolution of this conflict than at the negotiating table. Widening conflict and progressive escalation put the lives and well-being of potentially millions of people across the region at risk.
Ramina, thank you very much for this comprehensive briefing. I'll go now to Rick Papercorn from Jerusalem to update us on the situation of the health situation there. Rick.
Yeah, good morning to all of you and greetings from Jerusalem. I want to focus on two updates, one on the health situation, so both focused on Gaza, one an update on northern Gaza and the other one on polio. So on northern Gaza, so we as WHO, we remain and we are actually greatly concerned about the safety of patients, the health workers, amid this intensified hostilities and the current evacuation orders, and also very much affecting the hospitals mentioned, Kamal Adwan, Al-Ada, an Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. So we also appeal for every possible measure to be taken to protect civilians, healthcare, including patients, health workers, hospitals, and ambulances. So healthcare should never be a target. So WHO was requested by the Ministry of Health and respective hospitals to support the evacuation of critical non-walking patients from this hospital. We immediately planned this mission. We were requested on the 7th. On 8th of October, we were ready. The mission to Kamal Adwan, that's where the patients would be gathered and they would be brought, non-walking critical patients, they would be transferred. That was the plan to Al-Shifa Hospital and Al-Ahli and a few to Sahaba. So on 8 October, the mission was ready. And those missions are incredibly complex and enormous time consuming to prepare. It's not just WHO, it's with UN partners like OCHA, but also with our counterpart, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, with their staff and ambulances, cadres, etc., with a string of ambulances. So 8 October, mission impeded. 8-9 hours at checkpoints, etc., and holding points, mission impeded. 9 October, similar planning, mission impeded, similar reasons. Yesterday, at the 10 October, they passed the checking points, but at one checking point, very close to Kamal Adwan, they could not continue, and they had to abort the mission late in the evening. They were back very late in the evening. Other missions from WHO as well to resupply Al-Sahaba Hospital, for example, with fuel, blood units, medical supplies, were also denied on 9th October and impeded on the 10th October. We are always ready, and we're still planning now. We are now again planning with the team in Gaza to, when it's still needed, to have this mission to transfer these critical non-walking patients either tomorrow or on Sunday. But we need to be properly facilitated. So as of yesterday, it's estimated there are 19 patients still in Kamal Adwan, 41 patients in Al-Ada, and 28 patients in Indonesia. Kamal Adwan and Al-Ada remain partially functional. We cannot say that Indonesian is functional anymore. They struggle due to shortage of supplies, so Kamal Adwan al-Adam, including blood, trauma disposables, medication for patients with non-communicable diseases, and fuel. And the latest report, Indonesian hospital is no longer able to provide services or accommodate new patients. So, and I want to stress this point, Kamal Adwan al-Adam, Indonesian, were the only three hospitals who remain partly functional in the north of Gaza. It lacks, in the north of Gaza, primary healthcare facilities. We get this constant report from the hospitals that many other hospitals in the north now are running out of fuel. Most of the UN and humanitarian missions are not happening to the north. They're running out of fuel, specific medical supplies. And we are 1 year in this crisis. And this is a kind of, I don't get it, that we can still not have these humanitarian corridors to make sure that these missions can continue. So we request again, starting to request this humanitarian missions to the north, wherever, to the south, they need to happen. On polio, so maybe a little bit more positive here. The second round of an emergency polio vaccination campaign is scheduled to start on coming Monday, the 4th of October in Gaza, to vaccinate an estimated 591,700 children, that's the target, under 10 years of age, with the second dose of the novel oral polio vaccine type 2, NOPV2 vaccine. Again, this is similarly organized by the Ministry of Health, together with WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and many partners. Vitamin A will be added. I'm sure that my UNICEF colleague will allude to that process. The second round, we will have a similar approach. Three phases, focusing on three zones, the middle zone, the southern zone, and a northern zone, each involving at least three campaigns with an extra day for catch-up when needed and a day in between to prepare. Hundreds of teams are ready for to populate the fixed and mobile teams will be deployed, community engagement, awareness raises conducted prior during the campaign. Local teams will be deployed in areas that need special coordination outside so-called polygon to reach the children, which are not as part of the agreed polygons, and to receive the vaccine as we did in the first round. It's critical that they are reached as well. So once again, a humanitarian pause will be a prerequisite to implement a successful second round, particularly to ensure that all polio workers can operate in a safe, secure environment, and community and families can obtain vaccination for children without fear. So we renew our request for all parties of the conflict to implement these necessary humanitarian pauses in Gaza for the second round. Particularly critical as new evacuation orders in the north of Gaza are threatening access to hospitals and protection of health facilities and health and community workers. The vaccination teams, the parents, the children, of course, the children must be protected and allowed to conduct to make sure that the campaigns can conduct safely. And I want to close that we really, so this small positive, we really appreciate this commitment to this area-specific humanitarian pauses. We would like to see this, however, that this is not just for polio. We appreciate that this we can do this with polio, but it should not be just for a polio bubble. I just raised the other enormous challenges and the lack of supplies being available, specifically in the north of Gaza. It does not only apply for health, this applies for food, it applies for water and sanitation, it applies for shelter, it applies for many humanitarian items. So it's great to have this polio bubble, but I think 1 year in this crisis, we should have proper humanitarian corridors and a functional deconfliction mechanism, which is adhered to. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rick. And let me give the floor now to Jean Goug, a UNICEF Special Representative for Palestine, also from Jerusalem.
Good morning to all there. In addition to what Rick has mentioned, thank you, Rick, I wanted to emphasize the logistical challenges that such a vaccination campaign represent. The first, around successfully rolled out in September, presented humanitarian workers with overwhelming difficulties, including operating amid devastated infrastructure. For example, 75% of pre-existing Kolchin, critical for any immunization campaign, was destroyed over the last year as war ravaged the entire strip. In order to solve the problem, in addition to the 1.6 million doses of vaccine, UNICEF had to bring in refrigerators, freezers, ice boxes, and vaccine carriers, all equipment required to maintain the stock at a temperature between 2 and 8 centigrades. Another important challenge has been the endless population movements. In the north of the Gaza Strip, several displaced orders have been issues affecting thousands of children. Once again, it will be absolutely critical that not only the localized humanitarian pauses are respected in the north, but also that people are not forced to move from one area to another. This will be essential for us to be able to vaccinate at least 90% of children under the age of 10 among the population in all the Gaza Strip. During the second round, we will also take the opportunity to administer vitamin A to children. This helps to reinforce their immune system. It is a simple measure, but critical to support the health of thousands of children who are living in extreme, dear hygiene and sanitation conditions. Making sure that families are properly informed about this second round of vaccination is also a very important element. More than 800 social mobilizers will reach out to the families to raise awareness on the importance of taking the second dose, as well as to where the dates and locations of the campaign will take place. As we did in the first round, we will also broadcast radio spots, SMS message, and use all digital channels available in Gaza to amplify these messages. This outreach will continue until the second round concludes. Once again, local teams will deploy in the areas that need special coordination to reach children, including those who could not receive the vaccine in the first round. I want to reiterate, as my colleague Rika said, the importance of localized humanitarian pauses as a prerequisite for a successful second round of this campaign. We need all polio workers and nutrition workers to be able to operate in a safe and secure environment, and all parents to be able to bring their children without fear. We call on all parties to respect this. The first round of polio campaign has shown to the world that when everyone lines up, it is possible to bring critical aid to children in Gaza, included in the north of Gaza. It is not only crucial that this happens again in the second round. We should also be able to do more of this on other aspects for children in the Gaza Strip that so need so much. I thank you.
Thank you very much. In fact, thanks to all the speakers. I know that Rick has a hard deadline, so I'd rather ask you, if possible, to start with questions to him. But of course, we'll take them one by one. So I've seen first Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. I have one question for Rick and one for Ravina. Should I go with both?
Yeah, start with Rick, please.
Okay. For Dr. Peppercorn, what are your fears if you don't get access to these hospitals in the north? Why is it important, and what will happen to the patients? And could you just clarify, how many times now have you been thwarted on that mission to the hospitals in the north? And then I'll go for Ravina later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rick, if you can brief answer, we'll try to take your questions first.
Yeah, by the way, I have time up till 12:30, so I think we have enough time. Relax. So I think, first of all, the number of missions. So we have had three missions which has not been successful over the last week. So 8, 9, and 10 October. To assist with transferring those patients. And it's not just WHO. I want to really stress that point. We manage, we organize, etc. We do this, of course, in coordination on request of the Ministry of Health and respective hospitals. And we do this in together with there was UNDSS was involved, OCHA was also assisting us. Specifically, I would mention the Palestinian Red Crescent Society with a string of ambulances and carros. These are massive operations. We've done this many times now, unfortunately, to transfer patients to medevac patients within Gaza. They were supposed to go to from collected at Kamal Adwan and then to Shifa and Al Ahli. So every day it's changing. You heard this also from my colleague, and I think Jean was also referring to that. Every day there's changing initially. So we planned for 40 patients to be collected and to be brought to Shifa and Al Ahli Hospital. Now, with these evacuation orders, we get constantly different information. We know that a lot of non-walking patients, they have been moved already. Don't know the exact figures. I gave you some of the figures now. As of yesterday, there were 19 patients in Kamal Adwan, 41 in Al Adra, and 28 in Indonesian hospitals. Now, we do this on request of the hospital directors. We don't like to do this kind of thing because hospitals should be able to take care of their patients. But we know that when hostilities get close to hospital, and we learned this over the last year, what happens, there will be hostilities, there will be fighting close to the hospitals, patients cannot come to the hospitals, patients cannot leave, staff cannot come and leave, and WHO and partners cannot bring supplies and equipment. So very quickly, a hospital which is partly functional becomes non-functional. Then often there's problems with electricity, etc. Electricity will go to no fuel, there will be problems with water and food, all the basics, etc. So yeah, of course, we're deeply concerned about these patients, but also about staff. And we also understand that there is a number of people who actually, IDPs within northern Gaza, who've probably moved a number of times, that they are also sheltering around that around those hospitals. They might move, I mean, people who are able to walk, et cetera, they might have left already. We have to check out. I want to stress again, the WHO is ready. We are now, again, we have another meeting with our team in Gaza to plan for either tomorrow or Sunday to hope to ensure that we can assist. Because if there is indeed like active fighting around these hospitals, we know that patients are, of course, really worse off, and not only the patients, but also the staff. We hope, of course, that they can return as quickly as possible to those hospitals and they remain functional. I want to stress this point. It has been an enormous resilience of the health workers and in everywhere in Gaza, but also I would say in northern Gaza, that every time we saw that hospitals, because of the active fighting, became from partly functional, non-functional, they bounced back. They bounced back because of their resilience, health workers, together with support, WHO and partners. Indonesian hospitals was out of function for a long time. It's functioning again and rehabilitated. Shifa, well, almost destroyed, very much damaged, etc. You all see the pictures, etc. It is functioning partly again as trauma and trauma wards, and OTs, etc., OPDs, etc. It's amazing. And all those hospitals went through the same. Kamal Adwan has been out of service for a couple of weeks and bounced back. Al Ada, Al Ahli, etc., and even in the South Nasser Medical Complex. So we hope that, and we expect that this can happen again, because they should not be a target at all. On your, so that is on the missions and on hospitals. Did I address all your questions? Over to you.
Thank you very much. Can we have a long list of questions, please? Can we have short questions, short answers? Nina and then Gabriela.
Thank you. For Dr. Peppercorn first, and then I've got a question for Ravina later, if that's okay. It was just on the polio campaign. I was wondering how confident you are that it will be possible to carry out the second round of vaccination in the north of Gaza, given the current situation and the siege there. If you could talk a little bit more to that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure Jean wants to add on this one as well, but let me say from my side, the technical committee, which is the Ministry of Health in Gaza, the Ministry of Health, WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and many partners, they are ready. They're ready, they're prepared for this. And I think it was a major achievement in the first round. a massive achievement from all, everyone involved, everyone who's helped there, especially the team on the ground. Our move will also go to Gaza again on Monday to assist and to guide as good as possible. But I think, yes, I have confidence very much in the teams, the technical committee and all the partners on the ground. Hundreds in some of those areas, in the central and the south and the north, we talk about 400 teams which are ready to go and deployed. Community will be informed, etc. I am, of course, concerned about the developments in the north, and specifically, we know that within this evacuation orders, we talk about a total of 61 health facilities, 20 in the north of Gaza and 41 in Gaza, including the 10 hospitals, 90 primary health care centers, and 32 medical points are within the evacuation orders and zone announced on the 6th of October. Now, yes, we are concerned about that, and I think you heard this also from my UNICEF colleague, and we expect that this specific humanitarian areas, this pauses for the specific areas where we conduct the polio campaign, they will be adhered to by all parties. Then I'm convinced, then I'm actually confident it's a big word, because I think there's so many challenges, but I'm hopeful that we can implement this in the right way and in a proper way, and that we move forward.
Thank you. Jane, you want to add something to that?
Just to add that we also have confirmation from Colgate that we have received that it will happen. And we will have another meeting today. We will have another one on Sunday. And every day during the campaign, we coordinate and make sure that the hurdles that we have that they are solved. So it's difficult, but it's possible. And I think the collaboration of everyone on the ground, we are concerned in the north. These evacuation orders that have been happened, the displacement, also brings that we need to adjust our micro plans, as Rick has said, and keep planning each day to make sure that the campaign takes place and it takes place to the best quality possible. I think the teams on the ground are very motivated, and that encourages us to keep pushing, because with their support and only with them, we'll be able to do it. So the people on the ground, you should see the level of motivation in the last round. And we are hoping that in this round, but we are concerned, because the conditions on the ground are really more complicated this time, but we are working towards ensuring that, and we rest assured that with hope that everything will be able to move forward. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to add on this. Jean said in a micro plan is incredibly important. It's incredibly time consuming and complex. And I think what Jean just raised is probably the most critical. Every time there's changes, evacuation order, changes in the security environment, etc., we will have to adapt our micro plans. And that will, of course, have an impact on the coverage. So that's why the urgent request to all parties to stick to this necessary humanitarian policy.
Thank you very much. Gabriella, you also have a question for Rick?
Yes, one question.
Processo. I don't know if you...
Yeah,
if you know.
One question and one clarification. Could you clarify if Hamas is preventing Palestinian children from being vaccinated? I didn't understand that part. Is it the Israeli army or is it both sides responsible? And second question, what is the situation of your personnel and UN personnel in Lebanon? Thank you.
I didn't get a complete question, but I think for us, as Jean said, we coordinated and we planned together with the Ministry of Health, WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and many other partners. And of course we discuss and we have this daily meetings to move forward and to make sure that what went right, what went wrong, how can we improve? So yeah, I think everyone is on board that this second round of polio, that should become a success. So if you ask me if am I really confident, yes, I'm confident in that, and I'm hopeful in that. If we, of course, stick to the plans and stick to the agreements.
Okay. Isabel, you also have a follow-up?
Yes, very short. Thank you. Just on the missions. These missions were exclusively for evacuation of patients, or there were some other components like providing medicine or other medical materials or assessments? And secondly, you said that some of the patients had been already moved. Who moved them?
Yeah, okay, all good questions. So first of all, these missions are indeed, it's always a combination. We try to do as much as possible. So it's the missions to Kamalat 1 Al Adha and Indonesia, and it would be focused on Kamalat 1 because that's where the patients would be moved to be evacuated to Al Shifa and Al Ahli. That was definitely an mission to what we call transfer, can say internally medevac those patients, the non-walking patients, the critical non-walking patients. We also would help the EMT, the emergency medical team, which is working in Indonesia, and I think there was also one in Kamalat 1, to help them move out. That was the other thing. Now, the other, we were also going on the request of the hospital and the Ministry of Health, to take out a few medical equipment, specifically, I think, to bring something to Al Sahaba to take care of for the neonatal care, intensive care units, from one hospital to the other hospital first, to make sure that, you know, that we bring it, that specific equipment where it's most needed, et cetera, and also that they will not be damaged. So that was all focused on this mission. Other missions, and I think, and I mentioned that, I mean, for example, to Al Sahaba, where we were supposed to bring fuel, blood units, and medical supplies, which was denied the 9th of October and impeded the 10th of October. And this is, I really want to stress, so we get from our staff in the north as well, but also from the hospitals, if it is Shifa, if it is Al Ahli, if it is Al Sahaba, the Kamalat 1, all those hospitals constantly are short on fuel. They're short on specific medical supplies, for example, anesthesia and blood bags, etc. And this is our key request. Those missions, they should just go on. We should have a number of missions every week to the north of Gaza to make sure that we can bring in those supplies. We are ready, we have the supplies, yeah, we have the fuel, etc. So it's kind of unacceptable that we still struggle with this kind of what I call should be routine humanitarian missions by now. And it is not just for health, I want to stress that. It's also in the other areas. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick, and I know you have to leave us now, so thanks for that. I'll go back now to, and before going to the people on the platform, I haven't forgotten you, but I'll go back to the room. First, Emma, you were waiting to ask your question to Ravina.
Thanks, Ravina. It was just, I was hoping for a bit more information about the 100 medics and emergency workers killed. Can you give any details of how they were killed and who killed them? And might you be able to say how many of those have been in the last few weeks when things have really escalated in Lebanon? Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. Yes, I do have some more detail on that. So on the 9th of October, the Israeli Air Force reportedly hit the civil defense center of the Islamic Health Organization in Wadi Jilu Tire District, killing two paramedics and wounding others. On the same day, at least five rescue workers were reportedly killed when a strike hit their civil defense center in Derdgai. And previous to that, we have a whole list of attacks. On the 5th of October, on the 5th of October, the Ministry of Public Health reported that 96 primary healthcare centers and clinics have been closed. We've had several reports also of airstrikes targeting other medical centers and of paramedics as well as firefighters being killed.
Christian, I see your hand up. So Rick has left us, but maybe you want to add something?
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much, Alessandra, and thank you, Ravina. just to flag or to add a few points, since 8 October alone, and we're on 11 October, so that's 3 days ago, since 8 October, 34 attacks on health have been verified by WHO in Lebanon, which resulted in 94 deaths and 74 injuries alone. That's only since 8 October. And as the number of displaced people increase and the population is left with limited access to emergency and trauma care, as well as access to essential health services, including routine vaccination, essential child and maternal health care, and whatever cancer treatments and dialysis, we are facing a situation where there's much higher risk of disease outbreak, such as acute watery diarrheas, hepatitis A, and a number of vaccine-preventable diseases. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks, Christian. Gabriela.
Yes, if Rabina and maybe Christian could answer, what is the situation of UN personnel in Lebanon? If you are concerned about your own personnel. Thank you.
On that, maybe what you want to read, there is an extensive briefing yesterday by USG Di Carlo and USG Lacroix, who have been speaking at length about the situation of the UN, especially the UN interim forces in Lebanon, UNIFIL. And they themselves have issued a statement where they have spoken about these two peacekeepers who were injured after an attack. I think we have distributed to you the notes, otherwise the transcript. Otherwise, we can do it now. They are available. I think it's really a complete assessment of the situation in the country. But the bottom line is that they are there. They are really working in very difficult situation, but they are fulfilling their mandate and will continue to do so as much as they can. But really, there is a series of events, incidents that they have listed. So I will refer you to these two intervention to the Security Council first. Thank you. Nina.
Thanks. Rubin, I had just a couple questions for you. First of all, in Lebanon, the attacks on UNIFIL that have continued today, just now, if you could say something about from a human rights perspective, about how that's viewed. And there was also, there have also been reports, this is not in Lebanon, but in Israel, there's been reports of a U.S. journalist who's been arrested for endangering national security over reporting where some of the Iranian missiles fell, if you're aware of that, and if you have any comments on that. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Nina. I'll just actually go back to Gabriela's question a little bit. I mean, Alessandra gave you the fuller answer, but just to speak a little bit about impact on our staff as well. We still, of course, do have staff in Lebanon, and they are trying to do what they can to cover the situation, to report back to us. But of course, they're terrified, and they're very, very tired. This is what I heard from two of our colleagues. We are so tired because they have, of course, been supporting and covering the situation in Gaza and in the occupied Palestinian territory over the past year. And now, in addition to that, they're being personally affected, hearing the sounds of drones, of strikes, of bombings, seeing explosions take place not very far from where they are. It's a terrifying situation. On the UNIFIL troops who are there, it is clear that states have an obligation to ensure that they are not hit, that they are protected. And the primary obligation with that, of course, lies on the state of Israel to ensure this. The recent statements that were made were unfortunate, implying that their safety cannot be guaranteed. Well, of course, it is the responsibility of the state to ensure that they are protected and they are able to carry out their work that they have been mandated to do by the United Nations. On the journalist, yes, we've seen the reports. We're aware. We're actually checking with colleagues because we don't have enough information to be able to comment on that yet. But once we get more, I can get back to you on that. In general, of course, we've seen a lot of attacks against journalists, lack of access for journalists, raids of journalistic offices in the context of this conflict. And that's unacceptable. In in the midst of a conflict. There's so much propaganda, so much misinformation that is spreading that the work of journalists is more important than ever. But in this context, we have seen almost unprecedented levels of attacks against journalists. And we call for any such threats, attacks, violence against journalists to be thoroughly investigated.
And maybe just in more general terms, we really have to remind the fact that all parties have got obligations to ensure the safety and security of the UN personnel and property and respect the inviolability of UN premises at all times. It's very important to reiterate this every time. And our people, of course, in the field is doing that and following up with the belligerent on this. It's extremely important to remind everybody of their own responsibility towards UN staff and UN premises. And I see Christian has raised his hand, maybe also to speak about the WHO staff.
No, Alessandro, but I need to make a very... I have a very important clarification before this creates problems here. The figures I mentioned were since October 2023. So 8 October 2023, so that's 1 year. To be now coming back to this year, since 17 September, so that's this year, 18 attacks on healthcare have been recorded, leaving behind 72 deaths and 40 injuries among health staff. Health facilities have also been impacted. But important, 96 primary healthcare centers and health facilities were forced to close in the south due to rising hostilities. 5 hospitals were reported non-functional due to physical or infrastructural damage, and 4 hospitals partially evacuated and requiring the transfer of patients, including all those with various other diseases, dialysis, cancer, and so on and so forth. So important, the figures I mentioned before, not to confuse anything, were since 1 year ago. Thanks.
Christian, I see the faces of our colleagues here. Maybe it would be good if you could put this in writing, but Nina has a question on this.
Thanks. For Christian, so it wasn't 3 days then. I was just wondering then if you know the number of healthcare workers who've been killed since the increase in hostilities, 23rd of September, for instance, if you could, or the attacks on healthcare since then. Thank you.
So since 17 September, 18 attacks on health, leaving behind 72 deaths and 40 injuries among health staff without specifications now. So since 17 September, 18 attacks on health.
Thank you. So we have more questions, but not in the room, in the on the platform. Matt, I see your hand up. Is that something you wanted to add? No. Okay, so let's go to Ravi Kant, the Times of India.
Hello, can you hear me? Thank you, Alessandra. Just one simple clarification. I don't write for Times of India. I write for Wire and other Indian publications. Thank you.
Ravi, that's what you put in the platform. That's why I read it. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So my question is to Ravi now. That given this large-scale killings, indiscriminate killings from, you know, dropping big bombs, and also continuing ethnic cleansing of thought, are we actually witnessing a 21st century phenomena, which was witnessed in the second half of 20th century in Poland? Because in many ways, it has gone well beyond what the genocidal killings that were witnessed in the past. I hope I'm clear about my question.
Thanks, Ravi. Yes, it's clear. I believe you're talking about just the magnitude of what we are seeing today. I'm having trouble finding the right word today to just describe how terrible this has been for civilians, first and foremost. This is going to have an impact that will reverberate across many generations of people in the Middle East. Children who have been out of school for so long, children who've had their limbs amputated, who will be living with lifelong injuries, the trauma of families, the impunity that has marked this conflict, which means that it is going to continue to feed cycles of revenge, injustice. Revenge, injustice. It's so difficult to see. It is, we have been calling, the international community has been calling with one voice for a ceasefire, for the release of the hostages, for a return to some kind of peace. Every military escalation takes us further away from that. The right to peace for the people of Palestine, for the people of Israel, for the people of Lebanon, for the people of the entire Middle East, and the disregard for international law that has been demonstrated in the course of this conflict is also just horrifying. And again, what we need to do in response is to double down, to double down. You hear me coming here, you hear the High Commissioner speaking constantly about the need to respect international humanitarian law, and it is easy to get cynical about it. But in these circumstances, it is exactly when we need to double down on insisting that respect for international law is crucial, that it is a matter of international peace and security and human rights for the region and beyond.
Moussa?
Oui, vous m'entendez, c'est bien?
Absolument.
Merci beaucoup. J'ai en fait une question pour Tariq. Je n'ai pas bien entendu. Vous avez parlé tout à l'heure du nombre d'attaques contre les health workers ou health centers. C'était au Liban ou à Gaza? Je n'ai pas bien entendu. Et une deuxième question pour, toujours pour Tariq. On sait qu'il y a plus que 5 hôpitaux au Liban sont hors de travail aujourd'hui. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous donner une situation ou un update sur les hôpitaux au Liban? Ma deuxième question pour Ravina. Nous sommes devant un phénomène depuis plusieurs jours, même 2 semaines, avec la guerre au Liban. Les Israéliens envoient des messages. Ils disent, voilà, donc, à ces points-là, on va bombarder et les gens doivent fuir. Amnesty International, hier, avec leur enquête, ils ont dit que ces messages sont trompeurs parce qu'il n'y a pas toujours, il n'y a pas assez de temps pour que les gens fuient la région visée. Et parfois ou souvent, les raids israéliens touchent des endroits non, donc non visés à la France ou bien non marqués sur la carte qu'ils envoient avec leur SMS. Et encore une chose, c'est que il y a des attaques contre des immeubles comme hier à Beyrouth, donc Beyrouth ouest, c'est Beyrouth la capitale, là où les gens sont plus ou moins en sécurité. C'est pas la banlieue sud du Liban, de Beyrouth, et ils ont visé un immeuble détruit entièrement. Ils disent à la fin qu'on visait un membre de Hezbollah, et dans cette région, c'est connu qu'il n'y a pas de Hezbollah, et à la recherche, après, ils n'ont pas trouvé un membre de Hezbollah. Et ce qu'ils ont visé, il était ailleurs, ou bien il a réclamé qu'il était vivant. Alors, ces genres d'attaques, comment vous les qualifiez? Et ces genres de messages envoyés par l'armée israélienne pour dire aux gens aller à ce point ou ne pas venir à ce point-là? Merci beaucoup.
Sure. No, thank you for your important question, Moussa. Now, what international humanitarian law requires? It requires that each party to the conflict must give effective warning of attacks which may affect the civilian population, unless the circumstances do not permit. Effective advance warning. Even where a warning is given to civilians of an impending attack, that does not absolve the party to the conflict of its responsibility to ensure the protection of civilians, to ensure that the attack is carried out with full respect for the principles of distinction, proportionality. So again, first of all, a warning is compulsory, unless it is, you know, absolutely impossible, unless the circumstances do not permit. But secondly, even with a warning, it does not absolve the state of its responsibility to protect civilians. Generally, on your more general point, indeed, a number of incidents that have occurred in the past few weeks do raise serious concerns about compliance with international humanitarian law by all parties.
Maybe on the issue of the hospitals in Lebanon. I don't know if Christian, you want to clarify. I don't see his mic going on. So yeah, thank you. Just one thing, sorry. Jean has to leave us. Is there any specific question for UNICEF, which is still pending before we let her go? I don't see in the room. John, Lisa, can I ask you just to tell me if you have any question for Jean, and then we will continue. John, is your question to Jean? To UNICEF? You have to unmute yourself, John.
Hello, can you hear me there, Alessandra?
Yeah. Is your question to Jean, yes, to UNICEF?
It's perhaps partly linked to my question, because what? I was wondering if UNICEF is involved in repairing the health facilities that have been damaged. I think the number is standing at 26, and I think UNICEF is part of the cluster on WASH. If they're doing something with other agencies to repair the water facilities, which are a risk for potential waterborne diseases if not repaired.
Yes, thank you, Jean.
And my question
can you,
is for Ravina.
Yeah. Let's see if Jean can answer this.
Yes, thanks, John. We are involved in the repair of hospitals, water and sanitation supplies. We have done it for the Nasser Hospital. We repaired all the sanitation situation for the Nasser Hospital. So any hospital that needs water, sanitation, we are involved in it. So we will, after each of these incursions, we go back and see what is damaged, and we do repair them for water and sanitation for hospitals and primary health cares. Over.
Thank you very much. Lisa, have you got a question for Jean, or should I go back to John?
Yes. No, I have a very quick question for Jean, if I may.
Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah. Back to the polio campaign, I get the sense that you have not received any ironclad guarantees about a humanitarian pause. So I am wondering, will you go ahead with the polio vaccination campaign, even if you don't get these guarantees, in the hopes that, in fact, they will materialize? Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the question. Yes, we do have guarantees. We have had meetings when it was Wednesday. We had the last meeting with them, and they have guaranteed that we will have a humanitarian pause. As Rick also presented, we do it in three phases. We do the middle area first. That's Darbala, then we do Cañones, and then we go to the north. So each of these is area-specific humanitarian pause. So we will do that middle area. We will have a humanitarian pause there from 6 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. And this worked in the last round, and we are confident that it will work in this round. So we do have reassurance from COLGAT that these humanitarian pauses will take place. COLGAT is in coordination with the Southern Command, that is the operational part of the IDF. So that's we do have from, and we are from all parties to the conflict. So we are hoping that it will happen again this time. Today we have another call with them to keep reassuring, making sure that everything is in place. We'll have another one on Sunday. And every day during the campaign, we do have meetings to make sure that any issue that comes up is resolved. So we are confident that it will continue. It worked for the round one, and we are confident that it will work for round two.
Thank you very much, Gina. I don't see other questions for you. So thanks again for briefing us. And I'll go back now to John, who had a question for Ravina.
Yes, good morning, Ravina. I was just following up on my colleague's questions. Your human rights monitoring team, are they based in Lebanon or in neighboring countries? And how many are still operating monitoring on the ground? And if you have, by any chance, any data the way you do for Ukraine on number of civilians killed and injured, or the situation doesn't permit for that. Thank you.
Thanks, John. We have a regional office for the Middle East and North Africa that's based in Beirut. And we have colleagues there who monitor Syria, as well as covering the rest of the region. Some have left, some are still there. I don't want to get into exact numbers because those issues can sometimes be a little bit sensitive. But we do still have staff in Lebanon. On civilian verifying this, whether casualties are civilian or other, the work is ongoing, but as you recognized, it is very difficult at the moment. The work has begun. We are verifying, but it would be misleading for us to put out any figures at the moment because they'll most definitely be a very clear underestimate. So the work is ongoing.
Thank you very much. I don't see other... Yes, Gabriela. Was going to say, I don't say anyone, but yes.
I have a question for Rabina on another subject.
Go ahead.
Yes, in the last 6 years, there have been 150,000 intentional homicides in Mexico and an average of 8 femicides per day. Several states in Mexico are living with the terror of cartels. The government is not guaranteeing the right to peace of the population. So the country, there is no war in the country. So are you observing this situation? Are you concerned about this? And on top of that, the government wants to reform the judicial system. So what do you think about the situation in Mexico? Thank you.
Thanks, Gabriela. As you know, we have an office in Mexico, and of course we have been following this very worrying situation regarding the number of homicides, the number of femicides, as well as the large number of people who have been subject to enforced disappearance. These are all issues on which we continue to work with the government. We continue to try to monitor to the extent possible, and we continue to raise our concerns where it comes to our worries about institutions and measures that are taken to resolve the situation. It is, of course, important that all measures are taken in line with Mexico's obligations under international human rights law.
Very clear. Thank you very much. Can I let Ravina go? I don't see other hands up. Thank you very much. Jens, I haven't forgotten you. Can you come to the podium? But while you do so, I'll give quickly the floor to Catherine for an announcement because she also has to go. Thank you very
Bonjour
much.
Mes notes seront en anglais. Je voulais vous parler donc du prochain rapport. La secrétaire générale de la CNUSED, Rebecca Greenspan, vous présentera le rapport 2024 sur le commerce et le développement ce jeudi, donc 17 octobre à 10h30 dans cette salle. L'embargo pour ce rapport sera à midi le même jour. Intitulé « Repenser le développement à l'âge du mécontentement », cette analyse estime que l'économie mondiale est à un tournant décisif. La croissance est lente, encore plus dans les pays en développement, et combinée à l'accélération des changements technologiques, à la fragmentation des échanges, à l'augmentation du fardeau de la dette et à l'inflation, on voit l'émergence du mécontentement social. Le rapport explore les défis auxquels les pays en développement sont confrontés, mais aussi les opportunités auxquelles le Sud global peut rencontrer. Pour pouvoir les saisir, une nouvelle voie vers le développement est essentielle. Il faudra mettre l'accent sur la diversification économique, la résilience et une croissance inclusive. C'est ce qu'exposeront donc la secrétaire générale Rebecca Greenspan et Anastasia Nesvetailova, qui a dirigé la production de ce rapport. Voilà, j'espère avoir le dossier de presse sous embargo en début de semaine, donc je ne manquerai pas dès qu'il est prêt de vous l'envoyer. Il devrait être disponible dans les 6 langues. Et je vous annonce également les prochains rapports. Le 22 octobre, nous lancerons l'étude sur les transports maritimes et le 28, le rapport sur les pays les moins avancés. Voilà. Le service de presse est à votre disposition dès que tout sera prêt pour répondre à vos questions et vos demandes d'interview. Merci.
Merci à toi, Catherine. Any question to UNCTAD? Don't see any, so thank you very much for you. And let's go back to the last of our topics today, which is the humanitarian situation in Myanmar with Jens. Jens, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Alessandra. But just one thing, isn't it striking that at the same time, the same morning as we are looking to Oslo and the celebration of peace
of
there,
course.
We once again hear about the horrors and the inhumanity going on in the Middle East. And one wonders if there was such a thing as the opposite of a Nobel Peace Prize, I think there would be no shortage of candidates. Myanmar. The humanitarian community in Myanmar, coordinated by OCHA, is raising concern about the lack of humanitarian access and insufficient donor funding as millions of people face acute needs caused by escalating conflict, catastrophic floods, or both. Over 3 million people are displaced across the country, predominantly due to conflict. Since early September, 1 million people, many already displaced, are also affected by torrential monsoon rains and the aftermath of Typhoon Yagi. The flooding has been deadly, with over 360 people reportedly killed and many more injured across multiple regions. The floods have ravaged crops, farmland, and livestock, destroying the livelihoods of vulnerable communities. Local volunteers are cleaning up areas where floodwaters have receded, but persistent rains and swollen rivers threaten further flooding. Immediate response priorities include ensuring access to clean water, sanitation, and hygiene services to prevent disease outbreaks, as well as food and health assistance. Reconstruction efforts are critical to restore safe housing for families whose homes have been destroyed and to allow children to return to schools. Support is also needed for small businesses, farms, and livestock owners whose livelihoods have been shattered. So far, the response has included food assistance to more than 150,000 people in the southeast, northwest, and Rakhine state, with plans to reach an additional 73,000 people in the southeast. Over 80,000 people in the northwest have received water, sanitation, and hygiene assistance, and thousands more have received shelter, non-food items, learning materials, and other types of aid. However, armed conflict in Myanmar is widespread and generates immense humanitarian needs and displacement, particularly in the north, southeast, and Rakhine state. Aid organizations face continuous challenges in reaching those in need because of insecurity, checkpoints, and restricted access in conflict zones, as well as flood-related damage to roads and bridges. Yet, in the first half of this year, 40% of the 5.3 million people targeted in our response plan received some form of humanitarian assistance. Local and national partners are on the forefront of this response, working closely with communities and providing a lifeline of support. However, a lack of funding, as I mentioned at the beginning, is impeding the necessary scale-up in humanitarian aid. 10 months into the year, our $1 billion response plan remains critically underfunded at less than 30%. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. Questions to OCHA? I don't see hands in the room or on the platform. Katrine.
In fact, it's not for OCHA. It's another question related to Gaza, so I'll wait.
I don't see any question for Jens, but... Oh, no, pardon. We have Chris. Just 1 second, Katrine.
Sorry, Jens, it took me a while to react. You have a new boss. When are we going to see him?
Oh, you can Google him and see him, and there's plenty of videos and articles and whatnot. He no start date has been set yet, so for now the acting USG remains Joyce Musuya.
Okay, Katrine, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alessandra. My question is, in fact, for ILO. They were supposed to release a report on the employment in the West Bank and Gaza on Monday. They sent us a message to say that it was postponed to Wednesday, and we don't have any news from them. I don't know if someone of ILO is connected.
I'm afraid not. So the only thing I can do is take your questions to them, to Zeina. But no, unfortunately, we don't have anybody from ILO, so I'll ask.
Thank you. Thank you, Alison.
Anybody else has any other question? Okay. And of course, we congratulate the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. That's that Jens has mentioned, as you have surely seen, the Nobel Peace Prize has gone to the Japanese organization Nihon Idan Kyo, a grassroots movement of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I see you have a question indeed. Yes, okay, so I'm happy that I'm saying this. And maybe I can also ask Ravina, there are requests for comments. So I just wanted to, I, of course, we congratulate the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. It's a very important cause, and it's a cause which is close, as you know, not only to the UN heart, but to the UN altogether, because we were born on the ashes of a war, and we are here also and foremost to avoid wars and particularly nuclear conflicts. So this is an extremely important cause, and I have to underline also the fact that it's an important cause for Geneva. The presence of the Conference on Disarmament here and the discussion that take place here are fundamental for the world, and this particular association is this particular movement has been working with the UN. I remember a few years ago, I think it was 2018, they came to the USG for disarmament, Mrs. Izumi Nakamitsu, presenting a petition of 8 million signatures requesting the end of the nuclear arms race and nuclear conflict, nuclear weapons. So that is really a cause that we are looking at. We really congratulate the winners, and we expect a statement by the Secretary General, of course, today that we will immediately transmit to you. But maybe you also have a comment, Ravine, on this.
Sure. Thanks, Alessandra. No, to us, it's a recognition of the importance of grassroots organizations, and in particular, you know, survivors of horrific violations, for their tireless and persistent work, often away from the spotlight, without much recognition, with a lot of obstacles, with not always the you know, tremendous amount of resources at their disposal, but for them to keep going in spite of the horrors they themselves experienced to try to make the world a better place for all of us. So we welcome this recognition of the tireless work of grassroots organizations.
Absolutely. Gabriela.
Yes, what is your thinking about that Israel is in a war and they have nuclear weapons? Do you think there's a danger that can use again?
Well, of course, I think that the problem is exactly that. That is what we are discussing here in Geneva the whole year long. The issue is there's absolutely no way that any war can be fought with nuclear weapons today. We have seen the effects of the bomb in Second World War. We have got now weapons that are so many more times more powerful than those that were used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think that the work of this grassroots movement to fight against that, even I'm not even speaking about the probability, but even the idea that such a war could be fought again, it's absolutely critical, and that is why I think this Nobel Peace Prize is so important today. But I don't know, maybe you want to add something, Gravina?
No, I think Alessandra covered it very well, and we're still dealing with the impact of the nuclear legacies of decades ago. In terms of environmental damage, in terms of, you know, the impact on individuals as well. In fact, we had put out a report recently on the impact of the nuclear legacy. I might just forward that to you all, as this might generate more interest in the issue.
Thank you very much, Ravina. So if there are no other questions, and thanks to Ravina for this follow-up to the briefing. Just wanted to remind you that the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women will have a public meeting next Monday afternoon to hear civil society organization on the implementation of the Convention on the four countries to be reviewed next week. week, which are Chile, Canada, Japan, and Cuba. The Human Rights Committee will open next Monday at 10 a.m. its 142nd session until the 7th of November. There will be a meeting at Palais Wilson. The countries to be reviewed under these sessions are Iceland, Pakistan, Greece, France, Turkey, and Ecuador. And just a reminder that today is the International Day of the Girl Child. We've sent you the message of the statement of the Secretary General for this International Day. And just let me remind you, tomorrow, it's a very, very important day. It's World Migratory Bird Day. It is a fundamental aspect of biodiversity and environment, and it's important to remind it here. And on the 13th of October, very timely, International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction, and I believe we have sent you also the statement of the Secretary General on that International Day. So thank you very much for following this briefing, and bon appétit, and I'll see you on Tuesday, and bon weekend. Thank you.